I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Republicans vowed to replace the Affordable Care Act ever since it became the law. In May, the House outlined their plan that the CBO said would result in 23 million people losing their coverage. Last Thursday, the Senate unveiled their plan after 13 senators wrote it behind closed doors. The CBO is expected to score it today. The Senate proposal rolls back the expansion of Medicaid and changes how the federal government would pay for its share of the costs. It reduces subsidies for some who are paying for insurance and gives tax cuts to wealthy Americans who covered the cost of those subsidies under the ACA. Senator Mitch McConnell said he wanted a vote before the July 4th break. That would be by the end of this week. We've asked Margo Sanger-Katz and Julie Rovner to join us. Margo is domestic correspondent for the New York Times, where she writes about health care for The Upshot. Margo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. And we will get her hooked up. Hopefully we have Julie Rovner. She's the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow and Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. And Julie Rovner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And Margo, do we have you? We will move ahead with you, Julie. How's that?
Okay.
What is Mitch McConnell's hurry? And I ask that because this bill was written in secret. 13, I believe, all white men wrote it. Many, even Republicans, were complaining that they didn't know what was in the bill. And now he wants a vote by the end of the week. What is the hurry? What is the urgency?
The urgency is twofold. One is that the Senate and Congress in general wants to get on to other things, particularly tax reform. They actually, for complicated budget reasons, and they're doing both of these bills with a procedure that allows them to pass them with only 50 votes in the Senate. Republicans only have 52 votes. So for them to get on to tax reform, they have to do a new budget resolution. And when they do the new budget resolution, they can't do health care with only 50 votes. So they need to get this done. I think the reason that they want to do it this week is that they've discovered that every time they go home for a recess, they get sort of beaten about the head and shoulders by constituents because this bill is proving to be profoundly unpopular, even among a lot of Republicans.
I want to pick up on that. Margo, do we have you in on the conversation?
I hope so. Can you hear me
okay,
now?
I can now. I'm sorry about that. And welcome to Radio.
No problem. I'm glad
welcome.
To be here.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you and appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, especially talking about such an important issue. I was talking with Julie Rovner about the kind of urgency from the Republicans and from Senator Mitch McConnell to get this thing voted on this week. There are, though, at least as of now, something like five Republicans who are on the fence. Is there any way that you can see that Mitch McConnell can win them over?
I think it's quite hard to predict. I mean, Mitch McConnell is really a master of managing his caucus and finding ways to either compromise with various factions or twist arms and get them to abandon some of their concerns. So I think he should not be underestimated. But I do think that if you look at the particulars of the objections that have been raised by various senators, they are not all objecting to the same thing. And I think that makes it harder for changes to kind of mollify all of them. You see some senators sort of on the right who are concerned that the bill doesn't do enough to eliminate regulation of insurance under Obamacare, that its tax credit system is too generous. And then we also saw over the weekend Senator Heller from Nevada, who is concerned that the bill cuts too far into Medicaid and is in some ways not generous enough. And we've heard some similar concerns from Senator Collins along those lines as well. So how they kind of thread the needle between concerns from the right and concerns from the center is going to be very interesting to see. And, you know, the path to that is not entirely obvious.
Julie, you mentioned the fact that they want to essentially get this over with so they don't get beat up at town meetings. But if it is as unpopular as some of the polling is saying, won't they get beat up at town meetings?
Quite possibly, but they really do want to get this finished. They're messaging this as the really nobody's going to get hurt. That is the argument. That is sort of not what most analysts say when they look at this bill. But there is this desire to get this behind them and move on to other things.
Let me play something that the president said part of his weekly address, which happens on Saturday, and let's give it a listen. This is President Trump.
As families across the nation continue to suffer under this law, I only hope that Democrats in Congress will have the political courage to help fix what we know to be a catastrophic situation, a total disaster that they have created. To be part of the solution instead of obstructing, always obstructing change, blocking reform, and doubling down on Obamacare's failure.
Margot, Obamacare certainly had its critics. Has it been a failure?
I think a failure is a very strong way of describing how Obamacare has worked. I think that it is clear that Obamacare has not worked as well as even its drafters and its strongest advocates have hoped for in certain dimensions. But overall, it has achieved a lot of its goals. So, you know, from the latest estimate, which is a little bit old, about 20 million fewer people are uninsured as a result of this law. Insurance has become much more affordable for people with very low incomes in poverty or just above the poverty line. And insurance has become much more comprehensive. So, you know, many people who had insurance before, that insurance didn't necessarily cover everything that they needed. And, you know, Obamacare was designed to try to make insurance a little bit more robust, and it has done that. But it is also true that the hoped-for competition in the individual market has not been as strong as people had hoped. There are many parts of the country where there's really only one option of insurer. And, of course, there are concerns that next year might be even worse. That has a little bit to do with some decisions from the Trump administration, but I think also reflects some challenges in the new markets that Obamacare established.
Julie, I do want to move on and talk about the Republicans, but, Julie, just giving you a chance to weigh in on that. And certainly, you know, some states seem to fare better than others under the Affordable Care Act. The cost for premiums for some people really did skyrocket. For others, not so much. How should we, I guess, assess the successes and failures of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think you've just said it. It kind of depends on where you live. It depends what state you live in. In some states, premiums have been held somewhat in check. California has done sort of a very successful job. They actually, you know, look at premiums and decide whether or not the premium increases will be allowed. Some states that already had a dysfunctional market, they either had one dominant healthcare provider who could basically dictate prices or only one insurer, have not done so well. So it's been a very mixed bag. It also depends if you're getting help paying your premiums or not. The people who were getting help were kind of shielded from most of the increases. The people who were really getting hurt were the people who were buying on the individual market but who earned too much money to get any help, and they've borne the brunt of those increases. So there have been definitely winners and losers.
Can we tell whether those people would be helped by either the Senate or the House plan, Julie?
Well, it's pretty clear that some of them would. I mean, particularly in the House bill, the premium help goes a little bit higher. And, you know, in the Senate bill, it actually, in some ways, the premium help goes a little bit lower to make up for some of the Medicaid cuts, although it's unclear what kind of insurance those people would be able to buy. And even if they could buy insurance, whether they could afford the costs that they would then have to pay out of pocket.
Margot, let me go to you. And Julie mentioned the word Medicaid, and this is really central to so much of what the Republicans want to do. First of all, who does Medicaid cover in this country? I know it's about 20% of the population, but who's included in that?
Yeah, so it's a program that touches a lot of different parts of the population, and some of them I think are well publicized. So Medicaid covers a lot of poor adults and children in this country, but there are other groups that maybe don't get as much attention. So Medicaid covers a lot of Americans with disabilities, both children and adults, and it covers a lot of senior citizens who are living in nursing homes. Nursing home care can be quite expensive, and the Medicare program that pays for a lot of their other health care needs does not pay for nursing home care. So Medicaid is the major payer for those services. I recently wrote a story where we made a chart looking at some of the populations that are affected by Medicaid, and I was surprised to see, for example, that about half of all births in the United States are covered by the Medicaid program, and about 40% of all children in the United States are covered by the Medicaid program. So even putting aside some of those other groups, two-thirds of senior citizens in nursing homes covered by the Medicaid program. So it is definitely a program that has a very wide reach across various populations and is pretty important for those populations.
Let me play a clip. This is White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway. She was speaking on ABC's This Week yesterday about the Senate health care plan.
You know, Obamacare took Medicaid, which was designed to help the poor, the needy, the elderly, the sick, the disabled, also children and pregnant women. It took it and it went way above the poverty line and opened it up to many able-bodied Americans who should probably should at least see if there are other options for them. If they're able-bodied and they want to work, then they'll have employer-sponsored benefits like you and I do.
Julie, I'm not sure where to start with that, but let me begin with, did the people who receive Medicaid, as Margot was describing, Did that increase? Did that pool of people increase under the Affordable Care Act?
Yes, it absolutely did. And I think that the way to think about it is that Medicaid, before the Affordable Care Act, in order to qualify for Medicaid, you had to be poor and something else. You had to be poor and a child, poor and a pregnant woman, poor and elderly, or poor and someone with a disability. Basically, what the ACA said is that you just have to be poor. And they said, and they extended that up to 138% of poverty, which is about a little bit over $16,000. And the fact is, you know, what Kellyanne Conway was saying, that those people who were not, you know, otherwise unable to work should be working. Most of them are. They just don't work at jobs where they get health insurance.
Well, just picking up on that and going to you, Margo, and she says, you know, get a job that provides health care in health insurance. I mean, how easy is that to do?
I think for many people who have become eligible for Medicaid due to the Affordable Care Act, it's not so easy. They tend to work in jobs where health insurance is not available to them. They might be part-time jobs. They might be the kinds of people who are cobbling together a couple of different part-time jobs, none of which offer them insurance coverage. It's also true that for people who are very poor, even if their workplace does offer them insurance coverage, the premium contribution that they would have to make may be a pretty big chunk of their budget. The Affordable Care Act tries to create some standards so that people can afford to take up their employer-sponsored insurance, but Medicaid certainly is less expensive for low-income people. So there are some people, I think, you know, Kellyanne Conway is right, there are some people who might be able to sign up for their employer plan and they've chosen Medicaid instead, but largely the population that's covered by Medicaid are people who really just didn't have other insurance options and probably wouldn't have very good options without this Medicaid expansion.
Julie, about a minute before our break here, but is that the most sort of dramatic change, assuming some version of either the Senate or the House bill is passed?
Yes, I think, well, actually, the most dramatic change is not so much the rollback and the Medicaid expansion. It's the capping of Medicaid overall. And this was not something that was part of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. This is something that Republicans have been trying to do for 30 years, is to rein in entitlement spending, and they want to start with Medicaid. And for the first time since the program was started in 1965, it would no longer be open-ended from the federal government, meaning the federal government matched whatever states pay for their Medicaid enrollees.
But is it unsustainable as you look into the future? Is Medicaid unsustainable, Julie?
Well, Medicaid is only unsustainable in as much as there are continuing growing numbers of low-income people without health insurance. If there was a way to fix the health insurance system, then there wouldn't be so much pressure on Medicaid.
That's Julie Rovner. She's the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow and Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joins us along with Margo Sanger-Katz, and she's Domestic Correspondent for the New York Times, where she writes about health care for the upshot. And we are talking about the Senate plan that was unveiled last week to replace the Affordable Care Act. The House unveiled their plan in May. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think of the plans to replace the Affordable Care Act? What do you think of the Affordable Care Act? Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about the Senate health care plan, how it compares to the Affordable Care Act, and the House plan that was unveiled back in May. Margo Sanger-Katz and Julie Rovner, our guests. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Margo, let me go to you. And candidate Trump talked about that no one would lose their coverage under a Republican plan, that premiums would go down, there would be no changes in Medicaid. Looking at the House plan and the Senate plan, do any of those make good on those promises?
I mean, the simple answer to that question is no. And we saw a lot of other Republican advocates for this bill, several members of Congress, several members of the Trump administration, including the Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price yesterday, go on Sunday shows and repeat some of these promises. they really are just inconsistent with the effects of this bill. And we will hear about them in more detail probably later today when the Congressional Budget Office offers its estimates of the kind of coverage effects of this law. But it seems pretty clear that if this bill becomes law, millions, maybe tens of millions fewer Americans will have insurance in a decade, that premiums will be higher for many Americans because the government help that they're getting buying their insurance is going to decline. And that deductibles are going to go up. You know, one of the things that this bill does in order to make it less costly for the federal government is that it tags the amount of government support that people who buy their own insurance receive to a plan that comes with a higher deductible. So it's this very nerdy in the weeds change that they make. But right now, if you buy an insurance plan on the exchange, your subsidy is designed to help you buy a plan that covers about 70% of your medical needs. Under the Republican plan, your subsidy that you would be able to get if you're in the right income category would help you buy a plan that only covers 58% of your medical bills. And that means that if you have a very costly medical condition, you are going to be expected to cover a larger percentage of them.
Julie, the CBO said that the House plan would result in 23 million people losing their coverage. Help us understand how that happens. Is it that the coverage becomes so expensive people can't afford it? Or is it because perhaps if you take away the mandate, people are thinking, well, maybe I don't need to have health insurance for myself or my family. How do those losses occur?
That's both of those ways. That's exactly what the CBO said. It would be some combination of people who would lose Medicaid because the expansion would be phased out and they would no longer be eligible. Some combination of people who, because there's no mandate anymore, simply wouldn't sign up. They would decide to go without. And some people who would be literally priced out of the individual market, who simply could not afford the increases, the kinds of increases in premiums that would result from the House bill. So it was a bunch of interacting things that got them to that 23 million number.
And based on what you know about health care and the CBO, do you anticipate the scoring will be something close to that?
It's very hard to tell. This has been sort of the guessing game all weekend, among sort of the healthcare intellectuals. A lot of the Senate cuts are kind of back-ended, as they say. They happen gradually and over many years. So some of them might not actually show up in the Congressional Budget Office estimate, which by definition only covers 10 years. It's hard to know what they're going to make of the bill as it was released, which did away with the mandate but didn't do anything to encourage healthy people to purchase coverage. There's a lot of rumors that the Senate's trying to come up with language that they're going to have CBO estimate, but we don't know if that's going to happen. So, you know, this is why CBO has big, complicated computer models.
Margo, is this a tax reform plan or a health care reform plan? And we've been focusing largely on the Senate plan, but we could fold the House plan into that as well. But are we talking more about taxes than we are the health care system?
I think it's really both. And to be fair, I think the Affordable Care Act was both also. So if we go back to 2009 and 2010, when the Democrats were writing their health reform bill, they wanted to expand coverage to a lot of people who didn't have good access before. And doing that cost the government a lot of money. They wanted to give Medicaid to a lot of poor people who didn't get coverage before, and they wanted to extend subsidies to some middle-income people who couldn't afford to buy their own insurance. And that cost a lot. So the way they paid for it is they raised a lot of taxes, and there are various taxes that were part of Obamacare, some on healthcare industries and some on high-income earners. So there are taxes on investment income and on payroll taxes for people who earn a lot of money. And so what this bill does is it rolls back those taxes. It tries to take the tax system back to the way it was before Obamacare. Mm. But then, of course, it also does make these substantial changes to the healthcare system. It keeps some of that idea of subsidies for people who buy their own insurance, but it makes that subsidy system a little bit less generous, and it cuts back on the expansion of Medicaid to new populations, although it does it over time, and then it also cuts, as Julie said, the Medicaid program for all of the populations that had Medicaid prior to the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, it is not as simple as to say that it is one or the other. It makes changes to the tax system and it makes changes to the healthcare system.
As you were describing it, Margo, I was thinking of the wildebeest, you know, an animal that has been described as made up of a lot of crazy and extra and spare parts. I mean, it seems like our healthcare system is exceedingly complicated, and neither of these bills, and perhaps even the Affordable Care Act, does very little to try to simplify it.
I think that's right. And I think that sort of reflects a little bit of a political reality in the United States, which is we have a healthcare system that very few people love, but a lot of people like. They're scared of it being taken away from them. They're scared of major changes. And so what legislators try to do is they try to figure out how can we sort of tinker on the edges and make changes that address some of the biggest problems without messing things up for the people who are basically satisfied. And so I think that's what Obamacare did. It left large parts of the health insurance system intact, and some of their weirdness was left intact too. And that has made it very vulnerable to criticism. And I think, again, what this Republican plan does is it also sort of makes changes on the edges. It makes changes to the parts of the healthcare system that Obamacare changed. It makes changes to the Medicaid system for low-income and disabled people. But no one in either party, except for very far-left activists, are talking about sort of doing a soup-to-nuts overhaul of the healthcare system. And I think that just reflects the political reality, which is, you know, a big total change to the system would be very disruptive, and there would be a lot more people that might lose out or be scared that they would lose out.
We've done lots of shows about that. Let me get Caroline from Malvern to join our conversation. Caroline, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because I'm actually a home health care nurse, and I have a number of patients who are younger and therefore not they don't qualify for Medicare yet, but they do have significant chronic medical disorders that make it difficult for them to get out of the house. Most of them cannot work, and they depend on Medicaid to get the care that they need in their home, rather than having to spend lots of money to go to a nursing facility to be cared for. And I worry if the if this Senate bill passes, what's going to happen to my patients?
Well,
they don't deserve it.
Well, I'm glad you called the show. And let me give Julie Rovner a chance to respond. And I do want to play a clip of some a national disability rights group that was actually protesting outside of Mitch McConnell's office. But let me turn to you, Julie. I mean, should people with disabilities on Medicaid, as our caller described, should they be worried?
Yes, they really should. One of the things about the way the Medicaid program would be restructured is that it would put all of the financial burden for future health care increases on the states. And the states only have a couple of levers that they can pull to deal with that. They can make fewer people eligible. They can cut the benefits that they offer, things like the actual nursing home is a required benefit, but home and community-based services are not. So those would be likely to go. They could pay providers less, and perhaps it would be harder to get people who could provide some of these services. But there are really very few things that states can do to make up for the money that the federal government then wouldn't be providing.
Caroline, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And here is just a short sound clip from last Thursday. This is a group called ADAPT. It's a national disability rights group, and they held a protest outside of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office. And we're talking with Margo Sanger-Katz and Julie Rovner about the Republican plans to replace the Affordable Care Act. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Margo, do people on Medicaid or even some of these disability organizations, do they have a constituency in Congress?
I think to some degree they do, and I think that they actually have been sort of activated and have done a good job of you know, organizing protests, of putting people on television, of speaking to lawmakers to the degree that they can. So we're seeing people in the disability community really try to make the case for themselves. On the other hand, I do think that they are probably not the most persuasive constituency there. It's not a big group of people. It's not a group of people who are traditionally very influential in Congress. And so we will see whether the kind of activism that we've seen over the last few weeks is going to push this debate in any particular direction.
Who's the most influential, would you say, Margo?
Gosh, it's so hard to know. I mean, the thing that's very interesting about the process for this particular bill is that there's been very little involvement by any of the kinds of interest groups that typically are involved in Washington politics. And I think some people may think that's a good thing, that, you know, the Republicans writing this bill in some ways are writing based on a theory of the case, based on their own understanding and based on their values about what they want the healthcare system to do. But there also have been criticisms that, you know, if you want to do this right, probably you should consult health insurers. Probably you should consult patient groups and doctors groups and hospital groups. And all of these groups have been largely kept out of the conversation. So, you know, of course, these people have helped influence the ideas that underlie the Republican plan, but they're not, there aren't really at the table. There haven't been hearings in which disability rights advocates, for example, could testify and talk about how these programs might affect them in front of lawmakers.
Julie, I've heard a number of Republicans say there is a lot of waste and inefficiency in the system, talking largely about Medicaid, but I think probably even broader than that. Is there some truth to that?
Well, there is a lot of waste and inefficiency in the system, probably, ironically, probably not in Medicaid. Medicaid is an extremely lean program. Many people in Medicaid are now in Medicaid managed care plans where they get, which helps them with, you know, problems that there were previously where it, because Medicaid payment was so low, it was hard to find a doctor or a hospital who would accept it. That is mostly not true anymore. But yes, there is an enormous amount of waste and inefficiency in the system and people getting too much care and providers charging too much, and nothing in either of these bills would really get at it. What's important to remember is that because they're using this special budget procedure where they can pass a bill with just Republican votes, it means they actually can't do a lot of things that, you know, Republicans, interest groups, even Democrats would like to do. They're very constrained by the budget rules, so everything that they do has to be directly budget related. That's why they can do things like cut Medicaid or cut taxes. Those are things that you're allowed to do in a budget bill. But a lot of these more fine-tuning of the healthcare system are not things that you're able to do in a budget bill.
And these are the complicated rules that drive a lot of Senate behavior, right, Julie?
Absolutely.
Let me get Phil from, looks like Downingtown, to join our conversation. And Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My biggest concern with the bill is how it gives up $200 to $300 billion in tax revenue that could be used to support better health care. So it's not an issue of whether you can have more Medicare or less Medicare. Why are we giving up taxes on medical devices and high net worth individuals when we could use that money to provide a legitimate health care system?
Julie, you want to respond to that?
Yes, and it's actually considerably more money than that. I think it's more like $600 or $700 billion. But as Margo said earlier, these were the taxes in the Affordable Care Act to pay for the Affordable Care Act. So right. The idea that Republicans have been promising for 7 years to repeal the Affordable Care Act and to repeal the taxes that went to pay for it. And so that's exactly what they're doing. That's why this is being seen as a tax bill. These aren't random, you know, taxes. These were the taxes that Congress passed in 2010 to pay for the benefits in the law. The theory is if they're taking most of the law apart, they don't need the funding mechanism for it anymore, so they're going to repeal the taxes.
And that's Julie Rovner, and she joins us right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Margo, going to you, what about things like pre-existing conditions or the employer or just even the mandate itself? How do Republicans look at that?
So Republicans have really disliked the individual mandate, and that's the rule that if you don't get insurance, you have to pay a fine. So this bill does away with that. I think that's, you know, them following through on a promise that they've made for a long time. On pre-existing conditions, this bill is a little bit different than the House bill. So the House bill basically said that if states wanted to allow insurance companies to charge people with prior illnesses higher prices than people who were healthy, that would be okay. So people who had a prior pre-existing condition could still buy a plan under that system, but it would be really expensive. This bill doesn't allow that. I think in part that was a response to a very big public outcry and concern about pre-existing conditions protections. But what this bill does allow is it would allow states to opt out of minimum benefit requirements under the law. And that sounds really technical, but it's actually pretty important. So Obamacare said that if you want to sell health insurance, there's a definition of what health insurance means, and it has to cover a package of minimum things like prescription drugs and hospital care and maternity benefits. And what this bill would allow is for states to either change those rules or just get rid of them altogether. And so what that could mean is that someone with a pre-existing condition under the Senate bill would be able to buy a plan, but that plan might not include benefits that they really need in order to take care of their pre-existing illness. So, you know, someone with HIV, for example, if they bought a plan that didn't include prescription drug benefits, that plan would really be lacking and probably the most important thing that they needed it for.
Julie, Republicans who have been criticized saying that, you know, this is the Republican Party trying to ram this down the throats of members of Congress, they complain that the Affordable Care Act was rammed down their throats. Can you give a reality check on some of this process that's been going on?
Yes, and I wrote a story about this a couple of weeks ago, pointing out that this is an unprecedented effort to really keep these bills under wraps and then rush them out to the floor, more so in the Senate than the House, but the House to some extent, too. The Affordable Care Act, you know, went over a year before it passed. There were parts of that were done in secret, behind closed doors. There were lengthy markups in two different Senate committees, and then what happened was Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid took those two bills and kind of in private, you know, rewrote them into one bill, but he brought it out, and then the Senate debated it for almost a month in December of 2009. You know, again, there are amendments, there are things that are done, deals that are cut, and I'm sure that's going on now,
sure.
But we've never seen a bill like this that's been completely written in secret and then taken immediately to the floor in a constrained process. One of the other things they can do with this budget bill is they only have 20 hours of debate. It can't be filibustered.
It cannot be and only 20 hours.
That's correct. And then there's 20 hours of debate, and then members can vote on relevant amendments. They have to be germane, which is usually not the case in the Senate. They can vote on relevant amendments basically as long as they can stay awake and people want to offer them. I think the longest they've gone on one of these is about 36 hours.
Well, democracy at work. Margo, we're almost out of time here, but I don't know if you're a betting person or not. Will this pass the U.S. Senate this week, do you think?
I find this so hard to predict. I think it's going to be enormously difficult for the Republican leadership to do it, but I also think that this is a very important goal that they've had for a long time, and it appears that Mitch McConnell really wants the bill to pass, and so I just think we're all going to have to watch really carefully and see what happens next.
Absolutely. Well, my thanks to both of you for walking us through some of these complicated details of our health care system. Margo Sanger-Katz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Domestic correspondent for the New York Times. She writes about healthcare for The Upshot. Julie Rovner, thank you for joining us as well.
You're most welcome.
And she's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We have Ralph Mueller waiting in the wings, CEO of the University of Pennsylvania Health System. We'll be right back.
Virtua supports WHYY and is working with Penn Medicine to bring their neurosciences program to South Jersey. Thanks to this breakthrough partnership, you don't have to leave South Jersey to have complex brain and spine surgery performed by Penn neurosurgeons. And if you need care that can only be delivered at Penn, you'll receive immediate access. Together, Virtua and Penn Medicine offer advanced techniques for diagnosing and treating even the most complex conditions. Learn more at virtua.org/neuro.
Voters whose candidates lose are more likely to embrace conspiracy theories, and this is a bipartisan phenomenon. That's what Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, writes in her new book, The Trouble with Reality. I'm Marty Moscoen, inviting you to be part of our studio audience at WHYY on July 10th when I interview Brooke Gladstone about the state of news gathering. Go to whyy.org/events, scroll down, sign up. I hope to see you there.
Virtua supports WHYY and is working with Penn Medicine to bring their neurosciences program to South Jersey. Thanks to this breakthrough partnership, you don't have to leave South Jersey to have complex brain and spine surgery performed by Penn neurosurgeons. And if you need care that can only be delivered at Penn, you'll receive immediate access. Together, Virtua and Penn Medicine offer advanced techniques for diagnosing and treating even the most complex conditions. Learn more at virtua.org/neuro.
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And we've been talking about the Republican plans to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. Joining us now is Ralph Mueller, and he is CEO of the University of Pennsylvania Health System, one of the largest integrated health systems in the country. And it includes acute care hospitals, satellite facilities, hospice, rehab, and home care, and a primary care provider network. He had an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer calling on Congress to cover more people. I should also add he's a member of the WHYY Board of Directors. Mm. Ralph Mueller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You were listening as I was talking to my previous guests, talking about the Republican plans to undo, to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. What is your overall response to what the Republicans are trying to do?
Well, as you heard in the previous segment, a lot of people are going to lose coverage. It's on the House bill, it's going to be more than 20 million people. The Senate bill will have some sense perhaps today from the Congressional Budget Office. But, for example, in eastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey, the area we serve, over 2 million people will lose coverage, according to the Kaiser group that Julie is part of.
Because they're on Medicaid?
They're on Medicaid. To go back briefly, when the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, came in about 6-7 years ago, there were about 50 million people in the country uninsured. And Obamacare reduced that by about 22 million. About half of that got Medicaid coverage, and half of that went to what I call the exchanges, which are the ones where the premiums have gone up so much. So roughly those 22 million people who've gained coverage inside the U.S., about 2 million of them live in southeast Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey. So that's a part of the population that will lose that coverage.
I mean, this feels like deja vu all over again, because we know, you know, before the Affordable Care, I'm not saying it's perfect, that when people didn't have health insurance, they delayed care. Yeah. They used emergency rooms for their sort of general care, or if there was some kind of emergency. Is that what you see looking into the future?
Yes, and as we know, people who are sick take up most of the costs, obviously. You know, most of us are fortunately blessed with good health, but if you're in an automobile accident, if you're diagnosed with cancer, if you have a stroke, a simple number to remember, 5% of us incur half the cost in the country. I always call it the 5%, the 50% of the cost. So if you're one of those people who has that accident, who has premature twins, who has a stroke, etc., that's where the costs are. So one of the reasons the exchanges that President Trump and other people are talking about are, quote-unquote, falling apart, though that's not true all around the country. Many parts of the country, it's very stable, is if the only people who go into those exchanges are the people who are very sick, it's going to cost a lot of money. So the reason for the mandate, there are other ways of getting there, but the way to spread the costs, the way we're a large employer, for example, we have 35,000 people. So we spread the costs of the people who are sick any one year across those 35,000 people. If you only insure the people who are sick, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Sure.
So you need some mechanism to spread the cost. And the problem in some of the exchanges around the country, people didn't buy in, didn't opt in. So by only having the sick people come in, it's obviously going to cost a lot of money.
So you want young, healthy people to get insurance?
Or even people in their 50s and 60s. But, for example, in Pennsylvania, if the Senate bill goes through, a person making $50,000 in Pennsylvania who's 60 years old, at 60 years old, as you know, they're not yet eligible for Medicare. Medicare, you have to be 65 to be eligible. That person at $50,000 is going to have to pay $7,500 more per year of insurance, $7,500. And the New York Times, Margo had an article about a month or two ago and said about 40% of the American population cannot afford $400 extra per month of unexpected costs, whether it's a car or a health care cost. So asking people at that income to pay $650 more, it's just not possible. So I think the challenge for all of us in health care is taking away coverage from all those people. That will put those people back in the emergency room. It will cause them to not take their medications, which means their diabetes and their heart attacks will not be under control. So those are the kind of concerns that we have.
Let me quote Pat Toomey, Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Mm. Actually had a piece yesterday in the Philadelphia Inquirer. He talked about the Obamacare dramatically has failed to deliver on the promises of its architects. Millions who like their doctors and like their plans couldn't keep them. Increasingly, parts of the country have no Obamacare-compliant plans for sale. Costs have skyrocketed in Pennsylvania, he writes. Premiums are 120% since 2013. Competition is almost non-existent. 40% of our residents can choose from only one insurance provider on the exchange. He's saying, as others have said, the Affordable Care Act doesn't work.
Well, Pennsylvania is not as bad off as some other states where they, in fact, insurers have pulled out. We do, fortunately, in Pennsylvania, still have the Blue Cross plan. In this part of the state, it's called Independence Blue Cross. In other parts of the state, there are Blue Cross plans that cover people. But for the reasons that I mentioned, if you only have the sick people in the exchanges, it's going to cost more money.
Right.
So you have to have some mechanism to spread the risk. And Senator Toomey, I've spoken to him, knows very fully well that if you don't spread the risk across a bigger population, whether it's the taxpayer or other insured people, it's going to cost more. And I think the central policy dilemma in this debate is how do you spread that risk? So if you knew exactly every year who's going to be sick, it'd be easier. But we don't know who's going to have breast cancer, who's going to be in an automobile accident. So the challenge for all of us is how do you take – the reason you have insurance is because you don't know who's going to be sick that year.
And that's what the mandate is about,
yes.
Which, interestingly, was a Republican idea a
yes.
couple of decades ago. The idea of a mandate is you get everyone in and thereby spread the risk. And isn't that kind of what car insurance is
yes.
about? I mean, this is how insurance works, as I understand it.
You need some way of spreading it across the whole population. Now, Medicare does that for people over 65. Employer-based insurance, which is half of us in the country, unfortunately, where I work and where you work
sure.
and so forth, we have employer-based insurance. So half of us are covered by that and 20% by Medicaid. What Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, tried to do is cover those people who are above the minimum wage but making less than $50,000, $60,000. Those are the people who are uninsured. They tried to get those people insured, and both the House and Senate bill want to reverse that. And in fact, the Senate bill, as Julie said, goes beyond that. It wants to take back coverage from people who had it well before Obamacare.
So how would you improve, reform, change the system?
Well, as I noted, the health system, everybody should be covered. Now, obviously, there's a lot of political controversy. Some people want single payer, and, as they have in some other countries. And that's not doable in this country.
Why is that not doable?
Well, I think Obama considered that because certain parts of the Democratic Party back in 2009 wanted that, and there weren't votes for that. So, I mean, we have a little bit of a single-payer system in the VA system. We have it sometimes in the state institutions. And by and large, the American population doesn't want that. So what was artful about Obamacare, they crafted something that was publicly financed. For example, Medicare is publicly financed. Medicaid is publicly financed, meaning we as taxpayers pay for it. And Obamacare was publicly financed with some contribution from people. But it had it run by private insurance companies like Blue Cross and Aetna, private hospitals like University of Pennsylvania and Temple and so forth. So it was an artful compromise of where you kept the system in place of the private system in conjunction with public financing. And there's different ways of getting there, but you need some combination like that because we're not going to be like Denmark and England. We're just not going to be like that in this country.
Does or did the it still exists? Does the Affordable Care Act, though, need some tweaks and some fixes now that it's been in place for a couple of years?
Yes, but as you noted and Julie noted, some states like California and Maine and New York have run it fairly well. So it does vary. We have 50 states, 50 different ways of having public policy determined inside this country. So we have examples inside this country where the premiums have been kept down, people have been covered. So my sense is let's learn from the Californians of the world and do the same in other parts of the country rather than tearing it apart. Unfortunately, this has begun a political debate, as you've heard from the previous guests and the
sure.
callers, and I think tearing it apart would be a big mistake.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Ira. Looks like Ira from Haddonfield, New Jersey. Hi, Ira. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm looking at a quote on Fox from Pat Toomey, who supports the bill, saying that the measure does not pull the rug out from anyone currently covered by Obamacare. And that claim is demonstrably false, as the CBO scoring and your guest's reporting has shown. Another important point is that in addition to the direct harm that's done to the 74 million people, children, seniors, people with disabilities who are covered by Medicaid, which has gotten most of the attention, because of eliminating the mandate and because of the waiver possibilities, even people who have health insurance are going to be hurt by this bill. So my point is that people should check what their representatives are saying about the bill and contact them before Thursday to voice their
Fair
opinion
enough.
Because this is a dramatic change that will hurt millions of people.
Ira, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ralph Mueller, do you agree with his
yes.
assessment
yes.
that even if you don't get it on the exchange or you get it through your employer, you should still be concerned?
You should. I mean, changing essential health benefits, and they've kept the provision that was very popular in Obamacare. that adult children under 26 would be covered by insurance plans. But most of the other changes in Obamacare have been modified.
Here's a question from PJ. Says the elephant in the room is that the penalty for not having insurance was too low. That's why it was not able to insure more people and keep the cost down. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, young people who are immortal and they think they'll never need
health care. Well, they think they are, right?
And so even paying a couple hundred dollars a year in penalty, they decided not to do that on the assumption that they would need health care. So not enough people came in many parts of the country. As I mentioned earlier, therefore the people came in were the people who were sick, and therefore that's why it costs more.
This may be a little bit out of your area of expertise, but I think also this debate about Medicaid, which covers about 20% of the population, it does underscore the fact that we have a lot of poor or low-income people in this country, whether they're working, whether they're disabled, whether they're children, whether they're, almost elderly.
Let me make 2 points. First of all, two-thirds of the Medicaid budget is for seniors living in nursing homes. And many people of modest means, when their parents go to nursing homes and they exhaust their assets, they're now covered by Medicaid. So while we tend to think of young people being on Medicaid and poor people, two-thirds of Medicaid expenditures are on people in nursing homes. And nobody's running for office saying, I'm going to kick people out of nursing homes.
Yeah,
and so they should be a little bit more truthful about when they say they want to cut Medicaid. And in fact, part of the limitation in the Senate bill will, in fact, cause those people who are now in nursing homes to have all the anxiety of how am I going to stay in that nursing home if I'm no longer covered by Medicaid. Secondly, as we know, we have this opioid crisis inside the Commonwealth and inside this country. Many of those people are now covered by the Medicaid expansion. And now there's some debate inside the bill of putting an extra $2 billion into the Senate bill. But the estimates I've seen from Kaiser and elsewhere is we need roughly $45 billion. So to only put less than 5% of the total costs in to cover that population that obviously has been dramatically having their lives devastated by this epidemic, if we need to cover that population, then we should put the right amount of money into the bill.
What would be the right amount of money?
Well, the Kaiser estimate, we have to rely on these estimates, is about $45 billion, not the two that's in there.
$45 billion.
In fact, even the House bill, which we're not talking about as much today, they created something called high-risk pools to take care of the population that's sicker. They put $8 billion in, and the estimates, again, they needed $100 billion. So, again, to say these things are covered, put in $8 billion versus $100 billion in the House bill, $2 billion on opioids versus $45. To say it's covered and then have the numbers be so misleading is a real injustice.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Ralph Mueller. Mm-hmm. He's the CEO of the University of Pennsylvania Health System, one of the largest integrated health systems in the country. And as I mentioned before, he's also a member of the board of WHYY. And we asked him to come in to give us his thoughts about plans to a reform, replace, dismantle, whatever word you want to use, the Affordable Care Act. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Let me also note that the hospitals now tend to be the largest employers in most communities, whether it's cities like Philadelphia and New York or small towns in Pennsylvania. And the Commonwealth Fund, which is another healthcare foundation like the Kaiser Foundation that Julie is part of, estimated that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania will lose about 65,000 jobs the next few years if these bills go through. So it's going to have a devastating effect on the small hospitals around the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey.
How about your big system?
Well, our big system, we have some we're safety net hospitals as well in Philadelphia. We're fortunate enough to have a broader population base. But nonetheless, this is going to affect everybody who takes care of Medicaid patients.
Let me get Mary from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say how aghast I am with so many issues of this change in how folks are covering. But the one thing I wanted to mention was that this whole issue of how Medicaid would help those people that have going through all of their funds as far as living in nursing homes. I had a mother who was in a basic nursing home for 6 years with dementia, so obviously needed a lot of assistance. She went through $600,000 in 6 years. I was just getting ready to start the Medicaid process when she died. And this was a woman who worked as a library assistant all her life and saved her money so not to be a burden to anyone. And yet she exhausted everything that she was able to save. And so I just don't think people, that a lot of people realize how difficult this is as people age out.
Sure, Mary. I really appreciate the call to Radio
Time. Thank you for listening.
Absolutely, all Mary. Right. Thank you very much. Ralph Muller, you want to respond to Mary's
comment? Well, it shows you the complexity of this issue, that there are patients all across the Commonwealth, people who have, you know, that's a lot of assets to mm-hmm. use on nursing homes. So that, as the caller mentioned, these are families who had a nice savings, whether in a house and so forth, built up, and they exhausted that. So I think our elected officials should be honest with the population. Mm-hmm. This is what they're proposing right here, is to take away care from people like that, in addition to the kind of the more sound bites around the poor who may not be you know, in jobs, as Kellyanne Conway said yesterday, or in low-paying jobs. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, we've heard about the Walmart people. The people who work in Walmart make the minimum wage and are employed by Medicaid. In fact, Medicaid is the biggest health insurer for Walmart. The people who work there are covered by Medicaid in addition to whatever Walmart might provide. So I think, in general, it's a very complex set of issues here, and we shouldn't do this in a day or two.
Ralph Muller, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Time, CEO of the University of Pennsylvania Health System, and again, a member of the WHYY Board of Directors. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer, and the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, with Susan Greenbaum today. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.